Father, we open your word today to look at the truths that you have for us. Father, may your spirit teach us so that we might become and might always be the children of God. Thanks, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the story is told of a pastor who was visiting the fourth grade Sunday school at his church. And he was asked to talk about marriage because it was part of the lesson. And so he gets in there and he's thinking, I need to get everybody on board. So he asked this question of these fourth graders. Does anyone know what God says about marriage? And of course, he got nothing but blank looks, except for the 9-year-old boy in the back who raised his hand and frantically blurted out, yeah, he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, an article some years ago in the Washington Post was titled Open Marriage, Broken Marriage. And it has some very, very interesting insights. Listen to these for a moment, would you? Open Marriage by George and Nina O'Neill was a book for the Times. It said over and over again that you should be honest, straight, upfront, give space, let the other person do their thing, communicate. And if you want to have an affair, for God's sake, do be honest about it. Don't sneak around, make excuses, call late in the afternoon with a story about work. Simply pick up the phone and say, honey, I will be a bit late tonight. I'm going to have an affair. But there were these couples I know. They were not sneaking around. They were not lying. They were being honest. They were being open. Everyone agreed that it was wonderful. The men agreed. The women agreed. And I agreed. And it all made you wonder. Then they split. There was something wrong. Invariably, someone could not take it. It has nothing to do with the head. The head understands. It was the heart. It was, you should pardon the expression, broken. It all made you think. It made you think that maybe there are times we still, maybe there are things we still don't know about men and women, and maybe before we spit in the eye of tradition, we ought to know what we're doing. I have some theories, and one of them is that one of the ways you measure love is not with words, but with actions, commitment, with what you're willing to give up, with what you're willing to share with no one else. Well, today we turn our series that we call a marriage tune-up. We're going to return to it. We've been learning, whether you've been married a year or 61 years, doesn't matter. We've been learning that we have to come back to those original designs, those original specs. And today's message is entitled, Hard Questions for Couples. We're going to take a look at the place of intimacy and sex in marriage. Some of you just woke up. I like that. It's amazing how people pay attention when you say the word sex, especially in church. Everybody just listens. No one dozes off. In fact, some folks are really kind of stunned that we would talk about intimacy and about sex within marriage inside of church. But the question is, where else are we going to get God's viewpoint? Oh, it'll be from those ads that you get on your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed, right? That'll tell you everything you need to know. Or will it be from those advertisements who say, now, Patrick Allen, you can receive the next 12 issues of Playboy at 75% off the regular rate. Great reading at discount prices. I want you to fix this in mind. Ready? Go ahead, flip the screen. Read it with me. We should never be ashamed to talk about what God was not ashamed to create and to put into print. Look at it again. The two most prominent places we should be discussing this issue is the home and in the church. Now, what we've been doing is we've been exploring the major Bible passages that talk about marriage. And right here, I want to thank our single and single again adults. Thank you so much. You've been on this journey with us. You've been patient as we've taken a deep dive into each one of these passages. And as I said at the outset of the series, there may come a time when you will personally need these principles. Or at least, you're getting better equipped to be able to encourage and pray into the lives of your friends who are married. And I hope you'll join us next week, because next week we're wrapping up this series with a message called, "If I'm So Wonderful, Why Am I Still Single?" We'll be looking at that. So today we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. If you take your Bibles, turn to that passage that Paula read for us. Corinth was that city on a thriving metropolis on the narrow isthmus. I forgot my little pointer here. But it's on that narrow isthmus there between what's called the Peloponnesus, Achaia, and the rest of Greece. It was strategically located between two trade routes, a north-south trade route that went by land and an east-west trade route that went by sea. And due to the great risks going around the very bottom of Achaia there, the Peloponnesus, a great amount of storms, what most entrepreneurs would do is they would take their goods and stop at that isthmus and transport them overland to another ship and then sail on from there. In fact, they had a wonderful system of taking smaller ships and literally putting them on logs and rolling across that isthmus. And commerce was that big industry there in Corinth. But there was also a second big industry, and that industry was sex. Now, why? Because overlooking the city on a hill was the temple of Aphrodite, God of love, God of beauty, overlooking the city. There in that temple, there were, history tells us, 1,000 priestess prostitutes who contributed to Corinth's reputation for immorality. In fact, it's really interesting, in Greek, classical Greek literature, a word was developed. The word was Corinthianize. It means to practice immorality. And it's into this city that God brings the seeds of change through the Apostle Paul. And he does that when Paul leaves, and now months later, Paul writes back. He also comes back and visits the struggling church. You see, the believers in Corinth were coming out of such a thoroughly paganized background, kind of like almost our background today in our cities. They were bringing many of their old ways of thinking and acting into the church. Paul is asked for advice on a series of very earthy, very practical questions that make up the book of 1 Corinthians. For example, in chapter 6, Paul writes about the spiritual nature of sexuality. What was happening was many of the men who claimed to be Christians were still going down to the temple or up to the temple of Aphrodite to participate with the prostitutes in what was called worship. And so to this, Paul writes in chapter 6, he writes such things as, quote, "Your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. We are, quote, one spirit with Christ. We are, quote, members of Christ." The implication is, the picture here is that of no such thing as inconsequential sex. As Christians, we take Jesus Christ into every relationship and into every society. What Paul was trying to do was get these Christian guys to think, hey, you know, when you go up to the temple of Aphrodite, guess what? You're taking Jesus with you. How do you feel about that? And it was supposed to cause them to go, ooh, wow, that's not right. And then in verse 1 of chapter 7, Paul begins to answer a series of asked and unasked questions. And the first one is this: concerning the things which you wrote about, he says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now the phrase there, not to touch a woman, has nothing to do with a hug, a handshake, any other evidence of fellowship or friendship in the church. In fact, the New International Version translation is very unfortunate. It says it's good for a man not to marry a woman. That's an unfortunate translation because it distracts from the main issue. Dr. Gordon Fee, a distinguished Bible scholar, writes this. He says the idiom to touch a woman occurs 9 times in Greek antiquity, ranging across 6 centuries, a variety of writers, and in every other instance, without ambiguity, it refers to having sexual intercourse. There's no evidence of any kind that it can be extended or watered down to mean it's good for a man not to marry. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, see, there seem to be 2 extremes in the church of Corinth. The first, addressed by Paul in chapters 5 and 6, concerned the habit of these Christian men going up to the temple of Aphrodite while still trying to claim they were Christians. The other extreme was characterized by this saying, it's not good for a man to touch a woman. To touch literally means to light the fires of passion. Some believers were taking the line that celibacy, even inside of marriage, was the highest good that a person could achieve. It was the idea that, oh, you know, the body is bad, sex is bad, everything's bad. I'm going to be celibate within my marriage because that just makes me a better Christian. And Paul says, no, there's a place for that. There's a place for it in marriage life. And he starts this first part of 1 Corinthians 7 with some principles about intimacy and sex and marriage. And the first one there starts in verse 1. Look at it with me, would you? Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, each woman is to have her own husband. Here's how we can summarize this, okay? It's this way. Intimacy in marriage is planned for the husband and wife relationship only. Paul is saying that because of the prevailing cultural atmosphere, because of this whole thing that's happening in Corinth, each man and woman should have his or her own husband or wife. He's saying there's no need to find sexual fulfillment outside of marriage. Now, some people say, well, Paul's just talking off the top of his head. I don't think Paul was a theoretical observer, and here's the reason why. We know at this time that Paul was probably single. But in order to be a member of the Sanhedrin, the ruling council of the Jews, you had to have been married. So some scholars believe that when Paul became a Christian, his wife abandoned him, left him. Later in this same chapter 7, he speaks about an unbelieving spouse who will not consent to live with his or her mate. So Paul has some experience with this. And he says, okay, this is what needs to be the norm among you. So the question here is quickly this, is what's the place of sex and intimacy in marriage? Now, of all places where I talked about this the most was at a single adult conference. It was a single adult conference. We were talking about sex and intimacy as single adults. I started off with a question that kind of, you know, just kind of stunned the audience. I said, okay, with your neighbor, you don't have to do it here. I asked the question, what does sex feel like? Yeah, that was the response I got, okay? Half the audience went, I don't know. Other half went, oh, yeah, that's a long time ago. But finally, we brought it out, and we got the idea that, hey, it feels like giving of yourself. It's the giving of who you are. I said, that's great. Now, let's answer this next question. What is marriage? And they batted that around for a while, and up came the idea of what is marriage? It is the giving of yourself. That's one idea of it. It is the giving of yourself to another person. It's the public ceremony where you say to your prospective mate, you say to others around you, you say to God, I do not want to be a single adult anymore. Treat me as a married adult. And then I say, what happens at that point? Everybody said, you're married. I said, that's right. Sex feels like giving yourself. Marriage is the giving of yourself. So sex inside of marriage is a picture of that giving, of that promise made to each other. And then I made this statement. I said, remember, you're not married until you're married. Intimacy between a husband and wife is restating the commitments that were made, a picture of promises said. That's why sex outside of marriage is so devastating. It's a promise without a commitment. It's saying, I'm giving myself completely to you, but not really. And we realize that when God's statements are violated, tragic consequences come up. They happen. Now, God's not trying to put a damper on our fun. He's not giving us a desire that he says, you know, that he tells us we can't meet. I love what one person said. You might even want to write this down. I wish I had said it. One person noted, quote, sex is like fire. In the fireplace, it's warm and delightful. Outside the fireplace, it's destructive. And over the decades, a great deal of my time, counseling time, has been taken up investing in the lives of couples who are planning to get married. I usually have a minimum, at least six sessions with them. And in these six sessions, we plumb the depths. We probe deeply into the relationship. We discuss their lives from different angles, from different perspectives, you know, spiritual, emotional, financial, social, and sexual. And often what happens is not uncommon for some who plan to marry to have been sexually intimate with each other. And one of the things that I ask at this point is I ask them, before we proceed, I ask them to promise me that from that moment until the day that they're married, that they would maintain restraint, self-control in their relationship, that they wouldn't engage in sexual intimacy. Now, of course, what do? They ask why. And it's because that type of activity tends to cover over a number of issues if it's not careful. If it's not stopped, issues get covered over. Like, what are some of the issues? The biggest one is broken trust. It's broken trust. It's this. If my partner did this outside of marriage, what guarantees that they won't do it again? If it's going to happen outside of, we did it before, what guarantee do I have? It's not going to happen again. There's that broken trust. A second issue is one, I guess I call it the decrease in verbal communication. It's a decrease in sharing and listening. See, sex, the act of sex covers over a lot of problems and concerns that can only be addressed through conversation. You know, you who are married, you know, it doesn't matter how long you've been married, we all know the issue of makeup sex, right? I'm getting some head nods. Thank you. In other words, it's the idea that instead of dealing with the issue, hey, let's get lovey-dovey, and then we'll just pretend that there's not an issue here. And it covers it over. Oh, we're okay now, because look how much we love each other, when really all the problem is done, it's gotten buried like a weed. And a third thing that results is a strange role reversal. And it goes like this sometimes. A bride marries with guilt and disappointment over what might have been, you know, that ideal time. And with a mixture of guilt and anger, resentment, she soon feels like she has to take control of things because she wants to feel secure. And so she kind of grabs the reins and becomes a little more assertive, making sure that this violation of her security, her safety, never happens again. I'm going to be careful. You know, I don't want to feel insecure again. And the husband, on the other hand, he feels guilty too. There's a sense of shame. He's disappointed in himself. And that leads to passivity. God, I feel so crummy about this. And so he backs away. She takes charge to feel secure, hates it. He backs off and continues to feel guilty, all because the intimacy in the relationship was set in motion incorrectly before marriage. That's why that is so critical. That's why you who have, you know, preteens and teens, I get it. Talking to your kids about the birds and the bees, and you want to say, don't do it, and they pop back at you with something like, well, why? And you mumble something like, well, God says so. And really what happens time after again, we see these three things: broken trust, a dampening of the ability to communicate, a role reversal that leads often into marriage. Now, if you're married and this happened to you, I've got good news for you. You can deal with that memory. You come to God, you say, God, I blew it. We blew it back then. Verbally, openly, humbly, admit your guilt, seek each other's forgiveness. God forgives a repentant heart. God says, yes, I can go on from here with you now. We've taken care of that issue. But if we're going to grow in marriage, in our sexual intimacy, we've got to be committed to the fact that it's always a permanent, ongoing, open-hearted, monogamous relationship. Now get this, we can only grow in intimacy when we're secure in our relationship with one another. Some of you didn't write that down, but you need to. We can only grow in relationship when we're secure with one another. Every night I FaceTime my wife up in Sacramento, and I kind of messed up on Monday because I forgot she was at a Bible study. And the phone went off, and my ring call on her phone is a Viking horn. Da-da, da-da, da-da. And of course, Judy just fumbles around, and you know, there she is, and she looks at me, and I notice behind her, it's not our house. Hi. She goes, hi. Say hello to everybody. All the women in the Bible study, you know. And I go, okay, call me back when you guys are done. You know, and of course, what was the reaction of all the wives? Oh, that was so cute. Judy and I have found over these almost two years now that this is crucial. This is critical. I have got to help her feel secure. She helps me feel secure. Our second principle, again, starts in verse 2. It says, because of immoralities, Paul writes, each man is to have his own wife, each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, let me summarize it. Here it is. Intimacy in marriage is an expression of unselfish affection, not selfish desire. What is sex and intimacy inside of marriage? It's an expression of unselfish affection. Paul says, hey, a couple gets married, one of the things they have to agree is that they've now become one flesh, so they don't have really sole control over themselves. They're at the disposal of their partner. And I love this phrase. The emphasis is not on the privileges of marriage, but rather on the responsibilities of marriage. It's not so much on the idea of, well, I got to have my needs met, as it is, what am I doing for my partner to help him or her? See, intimacy in marriage is not just for my satisfaction, it's for my spouse's satisfaction. Paul says, hey, the husband has an obligation, it's an important thing to do to fulfill his wife's sexual needs and vice versa. This is keeping with that principle we learned back in Genesis 2:24. Look at it in your outline. It says, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. A couple working together. Later in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul echoes the same thing. He says, husbands ought to also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself. So Paul is saying, my body is for the purpose of giving my partner pleasure. I don't have authority over my body anymore. They're for the delight and response of my mate. Stop focusing on your own needs. Now, why is that so important? Because here, get this thing. What happens is, the minute I turn to my spouse and say, or think to myself, well, you're not meeting my needs, what do? I close down. I shut down. And what happens at that point? Do I start meeting my spouse's needs? No. She begins to shut down. And instead of meeting each other's needs, what do? We begin to manipulate each other, trying to force the other person to meet our needs. And rather than meeting my spouse's needs, instead I'm engaged in this manipulation. If we want to fulfill our mate's need for intimacy, we've got to talk. We've got to listen. We've got to know. We've got to understand. We've got to spend time. Because intimacy is that deepest form of personal communication. And there's one thing I find true in all intimate marriages. Here it is. It's a growing skill in talking and listening to each other. It's a growing skill in talking and listening to each other. Why is that important? For example, I talk for a living, okay? I talk here. I talk out on the soccer field. I talk in all different places. And as Judy has pointed out, that doesn't necessarily mean you're good at listening. And I said, what? Telling each other exactly what's going on And I don't know how to say this any more clearly, okay? The success of a marriage is in direct proportion to a couple's MWE, marriage work ethic. So let me ask you, what's your marriage work ethic? Hey, single adults, this is something you can ask your married friends. Hey, how are you working on your marriage? What are you doing to work on it? Not just what are you thinking about. What are you doing? Intimacy in marriage is an expression of unselfish affection, not selfish desires. A third principle pops up in verse 5. Look at it with me, would you? Paul writes, "Stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command." Here's the summary. Intimacy in marriage is not to be interrupted except on very rare occasions. Now remember the context in Corinth. Some in Corinth were seeing celibacy both outside and inside of marriage as showing greater spirituality. Some couples were abstaining from sexual activity inside of marriage, sexual intimacy, and going outside of that to get it met because, oh, our marriage is going to be pure. And Paul says, no, wait a minute, time out. There's some boundaries, there's some guidelines for this. In fact, over the phrase, where in your translation it may say, stop depriving, the word means stop defrauding, stop cheating one another. Makes it a little more earthly, doesn't it? Quit cheating. Well, I'm not cheating on my wife. I'm not cheating on my husband. Yes, you are. Verse 4 notes that there's an obligation within marriage to meet those emotional and intimacy needs of one's mate. Now, there are two things that we need to understand here. First, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I noted that the typical wife doesn't understand her husband's deep need for sex any more than the typical husband understands his wife's deep need for affection. Do you see that difference? And what happens? Boom, there's a clash there. A husband has a legitimate need that God put inside of him. It's a need that he has, and though it can be controlled, it can't be eliminated. And it does wonders for a marriage when husband and wife can begin to grasp how deep that need really is. Because when a couple comes together in marriage, when they pledge their I do's, when a man says, I choose you, here's what he's saying. He's making this commitment to her. Ready? I will look to you alone to meet this basic need. You alone, I will look to have this basic need met. Now, guys, we can have our needs met on all different planes outside of marriage. Shoot, I can go fishing with the boys, bowling. I'd never go bowling. We can hunting. I can find praise and admiration at work. I can, all those things. But this deep need for sexual fulfillment cannot be legitimately satisfied anywhere else but in marriage. And a husband is saying, no, this is where it happens, nowhere else. On the other hand, for a woman, affection is the cement of the relationship. Years ago, Dr. Ken Lehman wrote a book, and I love the title. The title is Sex Starts in the Kitchen. And his whole perspective was, guys, it's the environment of affection, not infection, of affection that needs to be created. It's that it symbolizes security. It symbolizes comfort. It symbolizes approval. And when a husband focuses on that and concentrates on it, he's sending his wife, his spouse, his beloved, a powerful message. Now, Paul is not endorsing he's not belittling abstinence at all. Because, like other spiritual disciplines, it has its place. But Paul says, hey, listen, we need to kind of categorize. We need to make sure we know what we're doing. And so he gives some principles. Let me summarize them for you. from verse 5. First of all, it's by mutual agreement. Abstaining from intimacy is not to be used as a weapon. Now, the phrase, I'm too tired or I have a headache, can be legitimate. I get it. When your head is pounding like, you know, 10 anvils are in there and you're just beat to the point of exhaustion, you know, that's the last thing. It's hard to be romantic. And I get that. But when this is used to put off intimacy because of other issues, there's a problem. Does that make sense? When we cover it over, oh, I have a headache. If there are other issues, you bring them up. You talk about them. You get some outside help to begin to aid you in making conversation about this. It's by mutual agreement. Second, it's for a set period of time. Just like abstaining from food or television or, you know, you're having a period of silence or solitude, sexual intimacy, abstinence can help you focus on the issues you need to bring before God. But he says here, don't make it open-ended. Set a time period, again, by mutual agreement. You don't do it unilaterally. Hey, we're going to do it for this time. Number three, it's for a reason serious enough to call for a focus on prayer. This is the reason Paul gives for this discipline. Something has happened, something has come up that requires a couple to give a more intense spiritual focus. And prayer, he specifies, as opposed to anything else, will give that. Okay? We're doing this because we need to get God's understanding on this. And finally, fourth, the couple would come together again in intimacy. There's got to be a renewal of the intimacy of the couple. If you think about it, you know what this is like? It's like a timeout in a basketball game. It is. Your team's playing basketball. They're starting to lose. What do? You call a timeout. What happens? All activity ceases. What happens? Your team comes over. You talk to them. You interact. You look. Do you get to do that forever? No, it's supposed to be 1 minute, except if you're watching it on TV, it stretches to six. But, you know, it's for a set time, and then what do? You go back out on the court and play. And this is the same way. It's done for a certain issues. It is for a short period of time, so the couple will come again. And why does Paul set these conditions? Look what he says there at the end of verse 5. You come together again, why? Lest Satan tempt you. Tempt the partners to sin because of their lack of self-control. Now, it's not that these Corinthians were sex-crazed, but again, what would happen is, oh, yeah, we agree to be abstinent, but he would head off to the temple of Aphrodite. And that's not the issue. Solomon writes in Proverbs 5:15. He writes a beautiful passage. I put it there in your notes in the New Living Translation because it has a little more earthy flavor of the Hebrew there. It says, drink water from your own well. Share your love only with your wife. Why spill the water of your springs in public? Having sex with just anyone, you should reserve it for yourselves. Don't share it with strangers. Let your wife be a fountain of blessing for you. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. She is a loving doe, a graceful deer. Let her breast satisfy you always. May you always be captivated by her love. You see, rather than something being hidden and shameful, the Bible always presents intimacy and sex within marriage as a jewel, sparkling with pristine beauty. Mike Mason, in his book, The Mystery of Marriage, writes this. He writes, I love this first paragraph. What can equal the surprise of finding out that the one thing above all others, which humanity has been most enterprising and proficient in dragging through the dirt, turns out, in fact, to be the most innocent thing in the world? Is there any other activity at all which an adult man and woman may engage in together apart from worship that is actually more childlike, more clean and pure, more natural and wholesome, and unequivocally right than is the act of making love? For if worship is the deepest available form of communication with God, especially that particular act of worship known as communion, And surely sex within marriage is the deepest communion that is possible between human beings, and as such is something absolutely essential in more than a biological way to our survival. It is something God ordained, God created, God given to meet what's going on in us. And when a husband and wife sit down and talk about these issues, something marvelous happens. All of a sudden, everything is right. You never have any more. Your washer never breaks down anymore. You never have any more fights. Okay, good. I'm glad you see I'm kidding. But it becomes a place of strength. It becomes a place where hey, I feel secure. I know that this is a place from which I can rise and I can move out into the world. Paul wraps up his counsel in verse 7 here, and he really kind of introduces the next issue that we'll look at next week. He says, yet I wish that all men were even as myself am, single. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Paul is saying that I wish everybody's like me. I'm single. I can go out and do my thing. But he goes, I get it. He says, some of us are divinely equipped to remain single for a lifetime. And that's good. He says, some are equipped to be single for a season. And that's good. Others are suited for marriage. And he says, that's good. Paul's not commanding one state or the other. He's not saying, like many of our churches do, well, you know, there's our marriage group and then there's those other people. No. He's pointing out the advantages of both. And next week, we're going to look at the positive things that Paul has to say about singleness. Now, this morning, I may have rattled your cage a bit. And for that, I don't apologize at all. Okay? But if I did rattle it a bit, let me conclude with three quick things here. Number one, when it comes to intimacy, many of us need a better mentor. Okay? Where did we learn about sex and intimacy? Come on, tell me. Television, right? Television, media. I don't know about you, but never have I come in, looked at my wife romantically in the house, and have music playing in the background. It never happens. And never do our arguments get solved in 30 minutes with commercials. Right? We got to chuck that image out the window. We got to go back to God's word. And here may I suggest the other thing is to talk, get some godly advice from believers who have been married over a time who demonstrate love to one another. If I'm going to learn to hang glide, I'm not going to ask somebody who's never hung glide, hang glided. Never mind. Who've gone that? I'm not going to ask somebody like that, right? I'm going to ask somebody who's done it. So you go ask them. Take them out for dessert. Tell them Pastor Pat said so. Take them out and say, "How did it work? How did you do it? What's your secret?" And you know the first thing they'll do? They'll laugh at you. They'll say, "What do you mean secret? It's taken us years, and here are some of the things that we've tried to do." Number two. Developing intimacy in a relationship takes practice. Remember what we said? You have more skill and practice to drive a car than you do to be married. We've got to practice. We've got to practice communication. It takes more than any practice than we can imagine. Because it's both a skill and a relationship. Yeah, I get into a relationship, but I have to develop the skills that go with it. Solomon, in his Song of Songs, writes about the skill. But intimacy is one of those deepest forms of communication. We have to take the time to learn the language. We have to practice. And I didn't put it up on a slide, but write down this third one. We have an ultimate resource, and here it is. It's the faithfulness of God. God is faithful. God is faithful. One of the things I enjoy about coaching soccer at this age is I don't have any kids out on the field. First of all, that wigs a lot of people out. You know, you mean you do this for fun? Yeah. But I enjoy watching young soccer players learn a new skill or develop something. And it just gratifies my heart when somebody does something and I can jump up from the bench and say, yeah, way to go, good job, that's great. If I can enjoy that, how come we have in our head that God sits in heaven going, why can't you get it together? What's wrong with you? No, he doesn't. He is faithful. He wants the best for your relationship. And when you take those steps and you give it your best shot, what is he doing? Yeah. Now, when my players try things, you know what happens? Sometimes they fail. And that's when I scream at them. No, I don't. That's when I say, okay, let's get back up. Let's get back up and go try it again. Come on. We can do this. And sometimes we think of faithfulness of God as God just sitting up there bored with his hand covering his yawning mouth saying, oh gosh, can you get it together? When instead, he's deeply and intimately involved. He wants you to have that magnificent marriage. Father, thank you this morning. I thank you, first of all, for yourself. You have not left us alone with things that we don't know and we don't understand. You have given us an understanding of what it means to be your follower, to be a man of God, to be a woman of God, to be a couple, to be a single adult. You've given us the guidelines. And more than that, you've given us yourself. Your word says that if God is for us, who can be against us? And Father, I take that promise into my marriage. That even though I can become sometimes do the dumbest things, I can literally set fire to my own efforts. That in your grace and in your mercy, you can come along and out of that fumbling, stumbling, sinning, you can bring me to a place where I can be the man, the husband you want me to be. Father, I pray for the men and women who are married here this day, that you would enable them, you would help them as they continue to communicate with one another. Father, I don't care if they've been married 1 year or 61 years. That they would be able to show the world what Christ in a marriage does. And Father, I pray for my friends who are single and single again. Thank you for their testimonies. Thank you for the purity of their lives as they live before you. And it's not easy. It's a struggle. And they turn it over daily to you. And Father, I pray that you would give them that peace, that sense of fulfillment, that sense of well done, good and faithful servant. Father, thank you for being the faithful God that you are.